Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. We're having a nice rain here, which we really, really need. I know there's some people having rain they don't need, but we really need this one. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. And is today like the first day of fall officially? Something like that?
I don't know.
September 21st? I think maybe it is. Yeah, so it seems like people get too much rain or they don't get enough.
I know. That's the way it goes.
And when it's just right, we take it for granted.
That's true. It's like anything else, isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So, Mom, who do we have on Writers' Voices today?
Well, today we have a very interesting book and author, Nicole Meyer. And she's the author of The Girl Made of Clay and The House of Bradbury. She's a native of Southern California who pulled up roots and moved to the Pacific Northwest, where she lives with her husband, three children, and a very nosy Aussie doodle. Visit her. Well, it gives her a thing there. But the book is The Second Chance Supper Club, which was a very interesting title. And it's really a good book. It's a book about family and about finding one's self, and it's just very interesting. I know you'll enjoy reading it.
Well, welcome to Writer's Voices, Nicole.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, the Second Chance Supper Club is considered in the genre of contemporary women's fiction. Is that correct? Have I got that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I am a women's fiction author, which just means I write stories about a woman's journey.
And is this like your third published novel?
This is my third. Yes, my third. Just came out September 10th.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you always want to be a writer?
You know, I get asked that question all the time.
And you don't have an answer yet.
Well, I have an answer, but it's complicated. Yes, I always wrote when I was younger, but I didn't realize there was anything special about it. When I was a kid, I thought everybody did that. And then it was only until I became a teenager, I became aware that not everyone wrote little stories, and I was more self-conscious about it. So I actually hid most of my stories. I did go to college for creative writing, which I loved, but I never really had the self-confidence to think that I could just strike out on my own and become a novelist right off the bat. So I wound up working for magazines and, you know, kind of shadowing the editor, internships and things like that. But it took a long time for me to really get the courage up to write on my own.
And what do you think was what actually gave you that courage? What was the turning point for you?
You know, a dozen years ago, I lost my parents, and I realized life is short. I was approaching middle age and seeing, you know, loved ones pass away or some of my peers go through, you know, battles with cancer and divorce and things like that. And I just thought, life is too short. If you have a dream, it's time to go for it. And so that really was kind of a catalyst for me. I also had a good friend take me to the San Francisco Writers Conference. And man, when I walked in that room with editors and publishers and agents and writers, I just knew I'd found my people.
Oh. And you never looked back.
I never looked back. I really just embraced the dream. And there was obviously a lot of failures and trials and errors along the way, but it was something I wanted so badly, and I just didn't give it up.
I'm glad you didn't.
Was the type of book that you write the type of book that you most liked to read?
Yes. I do read widely. I think a lot of authors will say they try and read across different genres because it's a good education for us. But I love women's fiction. I love reading books that are about a woman rediscovering herself. That's certainly what I write. I write mostly about family drama just because I know about it so well.
Is there a story behind that?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm one of four siblings. And, you know, with any sort of larger family, there's always lots of dynamics at play. But I do love the idea of stories about close relationships and family relationships.
I'm going to say there's nothing more important than family than family. And if our family, I think, gets together and gets along really well, and I'm so grateful for that. So grateful I have that you and your siblings get along. I just
There's five of us, and it probably helps that we're spread out. You know, so we don't see each other all the time. So we're all on our best behavior when we get together. But but we do have made an effort to keep the family connected and together more than a lot of families, I think.
Yeah, I think that's rare. You know, I've with my two books, the one that just came out and with The Girl Made of Clay, they're both about, you know, struggles within family relationships. And I've been so humbled and surprised by the letters and emails I've received from people saying, you know, maybe I should reconsider reaching out to my estranged sibling. Maybe I should forgive my parent who I haven't spoken to in years. And there's, you know, a lot of people who are in pain out there, but they really would love to have that family connection. But, you know, some sort of, fight has broken them up, and it's hard.
And there are things that you can't really repair. There are rifts that are too deep. We had an interview recently with a woman who wrote a memoir called Wholly Unraveled, and the abuse that she suffered during her childhood, I can certainly understand why she would not want to reconnect with her father.
Oh, gosh. You know? Of course, absolutely. Yeah.
But for many people, it's things that you can forgive. You may not be able to forget, but you can forgive. And forgiving is more, in my experience, is almost more healing for the person who's doing the forgiving than it is for the one who needs to be forgiven.
I agree. I completely agree with that. You know, and we don't always agree with our siblings' decision-making process, but in the end, you know, we'd like to support them and feel supported.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about what inspired the Second Chance Supper Club.
Okay, so a couple of years ago, I was attending an independent film festival in my town. I live here in Oregon, and we actually have a great film festival that comes every fall. And one of the documentaries I viewed was about a chef, and it was on a concept called underground dining. And that was a brand new concept to me. In the movie, the chef's life was kind of fraught with peril, but he was a Michelin star rated chef, and he was kind of running these speakeasies out of his apartment building. And I was fascinated. I remember thinking when I was watching the film, there's a story behind that story. And I left the theater that day taking notes on my phone because I thought I could make a book from this kind of concept. And then much later, when I really got into the meat of what I wanted to write about, I knew I wanted to write about sisters. And because I write women's fiction, I wanted to write about two females running an underground supper club. So it was the sisters.
Mm-hmm. Now, this, I guess, is a real thing then, these underground supper clubs.
Yes, it's a real thing. It's mostly popular in larger cities. It's kind of the concept of pop-up restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
But they're truly kind of clandestine supper clubs where it's not really advertised. It's word of mouth, you know, for invitation only. And it could be in an apartment, or could be in a wine cellar. It could be in the back room of a real restaurant. And it's really a place where food enthusiasts gather, and the chef will, you know, put on a full, sometimes 7-course meal. And, it's definitely becoming a trend. I recently spoke to a woman who works for one in Los Angeles, and she said it's like a 3-month waiting list just to get in there.
And you have to be in the know.
Yes, you have to be in the know.
And in some cases, like in the case of the Second Chance Supper Club, it's quasi-legal.
Yeah. I love how you put that. Yes, it's they're not, the person running it's not going to go to jail, but they certainly will be shut down and there will be heavy fines, just because the health inspections don't happen at that level because it is sort of a secret location. But these usually high caliber chefs, like I said, you know, oftentimes Michelin star rated chefs who really take their craft to heart and take it very seriously.
And what is the motivation for a chef to do this rather than have a restaurant?
You know, I can't speak from experience, but I imagine that it's because they are fed up with the industry, probably fed up for working for someone else, or they want to just push the limits of their creativity, and their current position at a restaurant does not allow for that. And these chefs have followings. You know, a lot of times they're looked at by foodies as sort of celebrities. Mm-hmm. And so their following will go to where they're cooking, and they have the freedom to really do whatever they want for really appreciative clientele.
And in this case, and I'm sure this is probably how they usually work, the chef determines what's being served that night. People don't come in and order.
Yes, exactly. They, like I said, sometimes it could be a 7-course meal, and it's the chef's decision. And it's usually something local and new and exciting. And they like to push their limits and see if the customers agree, you know.
Well, you know, there's so many details in this book of the food and how she prepares it and everything. How did you know all that? You had to do some research on that, I assume.
Yes, a lot of research. I watched a lot of YouTube videos. I do like to cook, but certainly not at that level. And so I just did as much research as I could, and that was really fun. You know, you can watch so many chefs cooking online and just describing their food, and that was really fun for me. I love the research.
How did you create the menus that were used in the story?
Oh my gosh. Well, it was a combination of, you know, things that I researched, and also the locale. I thought it was important for my character Ginny, who is the chef in the book. I thought it was important for her to, you know, support local farms and local butchers and growers and things. So I tried to think about what would be in the area. She's actually in the desert of Arizona. And so there's a tiny bit of Southwest influence, but also she came from a big city in Manhattan, New York. So she kind of brought her recipes with her as well. But it was definitely some research.
Yeah, because there were times there where when she went to the farmer's market and there was local produce there, and she wanted to use that in her recipes, and that was interesting. When she told that lady how to pick out a certain, was it a squash or something?
Yes.
And, I thought that was interesting.
And did you learn that on YouTube too?
No, I mean, I have to admit that I'm sort of an avid farmer's market attendee myself. You know, I live in Oregon, and there are so many amazing farms and ranches around here. And so we have two very big, I shouldn't say very big, but big for where I live, farmers market that happen spring and summer. And it's amazing to go, just stall after stall of these gorgeous vegetables and fruits and locally caught fish. And it's so inspiring to go. And it makes me want to, you know, try new recipes because there's so much out there.
You know, the revival of farmers markets is really fun to watch. I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and the Lancaster County Farmers Market, I think, is the oldest, one of the oldest continually operating, if not the oldest. And it's in a big building, kind of open air mm-hmm. building. And the stalls, the stalls are permanent. So there's other places like that. I know there's one up in Vancouver on I think it's Granville Island that's like that. And they're, you know, just the sights and the sounds and smells and of these places is pretty, it's a feast for the senses.
It absolutely is. And when you're talking about that, it brings to mind, we have Pike's Place in Seattle here in the Pacific Northwest. And that's an amazing permanent outdoor farmers market.
Yeah. Now, why did you set this in Arizona?
Well, I thought it was important to take two city girls and kind of pick them up and force them to grow roots where they're planted. I wanted to kind of shake up their environment. And I truthfully am such a fan of the desert, whether it's Tucson, Arizona, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Palm Desert, California. When I like to go take kind of a little break and be alone and go write, I usually pick the desert because to me it's very magical. They have beautiful sunsets and the landscape is very spiritual. And when I was starting to write the book, I actually was on a little sabbatical in Tucson, Arizona. And I just thought, oh, this is the best setting. I want to see if I can, you know, put this in the book. So that's why I chose Arizona.
So you were actually in the locale to be able to describe it. And I'm assuming you went to the farmer's market there.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoy that setting. And it was just no question that that's where I wanted to place the girls, because they also need to be a little bit isolated from the creature comforts of a city. And I felt that that was the right move for them.
Now,
and also because Julia was, you know, trying to get away from that whole thing and
yes,
her former life, I could say. So that was good. That was good.
So Julia's running away from some problems that occurred as in her career as a broadcast journalist in New York City. How did you research how that would work?
Oh, the broadcast journalism part?
Yes.
Yeah, that was just a lot of research. I pulled on a few, you know, things that I remembered when I used to work, you know, in for magazines and journalism back in the day. And then I just researched as much as I could what the current landscape would look like for broadcast journalism in the city. And I thought it was an interesting time because we are all faced with the changing climate of the media right now anyway, and sort of the accusations of, is this, you know, truth, or is this just something that is just, you know, media spreading, or it's online. And I think that there's just a real shakeup right now going on in the media. And I thought it was great to have a woman sort of, you know, being pushed out by maybe a younger model, and she's frantic to keep her job. So she'll just sort of say some piece of sensationalism on air to try and get the ratings up and keep her job.
And what I was curious about was, and I really don't know the answer to this, so she was an anchor on a morning show, I think.
Yes.
And how much actual reporting do the anchors, you know, the faces of these shows, are they actually out there getting stories?
You know, I think it depends on the network. I certainly think that the up-and-coming anchors have worked, you know, prior to that position as a reporter or, you know, out on the street. They don't write all of their material. They definitely have writers that do all of that, but they have these big sort of editorial meetings where they can pitch ideas, and if the producer likes it, they can run with it. But no, that doesn't happen all the time.
Okay. So because Julia really seemed to still want to be an investigative reporter, even though she was now, you know, the person on the desk, on the air. And I wondered how often those people are actually still doing the investigations.
Yeah, it just depends on the network. I mean, I'm a huge fan of 60 Minutes, and I know that a lot of those anchors do investigate their own stories. It just depends on the network.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Well, why don't you read to us a little bit from the Second Chance Supper Club?
Okay. So I thought maybe I would read the chapter where, so the two sisters have been estranged for 3 years. And I thought I'd read from the chapter where they finally reconnect for the first time. So just to set the scene, Ginny is running her underground supper club in Arizona. Julia has just made a colossal mistake at work in New York and kind of has to tuck tail and leave town. So she flies to go find her sister, Ginny. And Julia has just arrived and thinks that she sees Ginny's house and thinks she sees Ginny's 21-year-old daughter fleeing the scene. So this chapter is actually told from Ginny's perspective. Okay, so chapter 9, Ginny. The words caught in Ginny's throat. Discovering her younger sister in her doorway had kicked up an unexpected tornado of grief and anxiety that swirled wildly inside her. Standing speechless, she tried to unscramble the bizarre turn of events. First, Olive had stormed out. In her place, astoundingly, was her little sister, whom she hadn't seen or heard from in years. 3 long years of tension and resentment and silence. What exactly was going on? Her eyes searched Julia with disbelief. There was her sister, looking like she hadn't aged a bit, all polished and put together and expectant. This was real. It just made no sense. A burst of laughter, followed by the clinking of stemware, trailed out from somewhere behind the dining room. Ginny cringed and then threw an uneasy glimpse over her shoulder toward the waiting guests. Hastily, she whipped her focus back to her sister. "Aren't you going to invite me inside? What are you doing here?" Ginny's inquiry was delivered with an edge of accusation. She opened her mouth to ask another question, but then snapped it shut. She hadn't meant it to sound that way, but this was the worst possible timing for an unannounced visit, especially one that could be volatile. She and her sister hadn't exactly parted on the best of terms, and now she didn't know how to feel or what Julia wanted. "I came to see you, and Olive." Julia's voice croaked, and she offered a timid smile. "Surprise!" "Yeah, surprise is right." Ginny ran a hand over the back of her neck, her level of discomfort rising. Julia waited with blinking eyes. "I thought you might be Olive." "I think I saw her driving away," Julia said. A manicured hand waved in the direction of the road. "Does she have a Jeep?" "That was her." Ginny deflated. She swiped the tea towel she was wearing at her forehead and then let it drop to her side. "Damn, I can't believe she took off like that." She scanned the distance beyond Julia's shoulders. Fresh anxiety bubbled up. What was she going to do now? There was an entire evening's worth of dinner guests to wait on and no one around to help. Ginny couldn't afford to send anyone away. There was too much riding on the evening. Julia shifted, clearly uncomfortable. "Oh, well, hopefully she'll be back soon." "I don't know." Ginny felt the hope draining out of her. She studied Julia. "This is quite a surprise, but it's kind of a, She wavered. One part of her wanted to grab Julia by the shoulders and pull her close, to pepper her with questions about why she'd come, to find out if Julia was sorry and if she'd finally come to make amends. But the other part of her, the practical and responsible side, needed to send Julia away before the damage could be done. There was an entire room full of customers, paying customers, waiting for her. Food was likely burning on the stove at that very moment. Sauces would be curdled. Vegetables would go limp. Ginny had her daughter to blame. Olive had gotten too angry and left her mother in the lurch, right in the middle of preparing the main course. Because of this, there was now no one to serve, and time was not on Ginny's side. The evening was already running terribly behind, thanks to Olive's antics, and another shift of diners was expected to arrive shortly. On top of all of this, Ginny's only sibling had shockingly appeared out of nowhere and landed on her doorstep with a heavy look of expectation. What was Ginny supposed to do? Julia faltered in the doorway, the points of her high heels balancing just over the threshold. Her voice rose into a tight question. "I could come back tomorrow if you want." What was she to say? Ginny's mind raced. Her eyes darted to her wristwatch. She was so far behind. Plus, she was worn out. Between fighting with Olive and trying to keep up with the demanding double shift, her Her limbs were weary and her head ached. A layer of sticky sweat had settled just underneath her chef's coat. All she wanted to do was find a soft spot and collapse. But there was no time for that, not if she wanted to keep Mesquite's reputation and get paid. She summoned up a bit of energy and then studied Julia. "You for sure saw Olive take off in her Jeep." Julia pumped her head. "Yeah, she looked like she was kind of in a hurry." Jenny snorted. "You could say that." "Anything I can do to help?" Help. She did need assistance, preferably from Olive. Jenny's mouth twisted. She was ready to decline Julia's offer. It was absurd to involve her sister. Mesquite wasn't for everyone, and Jenny preferred to keep it that way. Besides, Julia surely didn't realize what she was asking, and she wasn't normally one to be relied on for help. Not really. But still, should Jenny accept? She didn't want to. The rational side of her brain knew doing so would turn out disastrous. How could she not? Yet Jenny's present circumstances felt equally absurd. She was overextended in every sense of the word. Gathering herself up, Jenny prepared to eat crow.
And that was Nicole Meyer reading from Second Chance Supper Club, and you are listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. So,
and then you get this at page turner because you want to know what happened.
So you read us a chapter from Ginny's point of view, and there's also chapters from Julia's point of view. So I wanted to ask why you made the decision to do it from multiple points of view and whether that makes it easier or harder to write.
Oh gosh, it's always a challenge, for me at least, to write different points of view because you have to make sure each voice is sort of unique, and that the reader can tell the voices apart. But I thought it was important in this scenario because everyone behaves the way they do because there's a backstory. And I thought it was so important to show Julia's backstory and Jenny's backstory from their perspective. I think it makes them a little more human. I think it lets the reader maybe root for them a little bit more. But yes, it definitely is hard for me.
Do you have the storyline all figured out before you start writing?
Oh, gosh. I have a lot of it figured out. I actually have a publisher who likes to see a full synopsis, which is beginning, middle, and end of a story before contracts are signed and we move forward. So part of me is expected to know most of the story. But certainly as I go forward, and a lot of writers will say this, even if they have an outline, once you start writing, things change.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're writing after you get the contract. Has that always been the case for you?
No, it hasn't always been the case. My very first book, which was The House of Bradbury, was something I call, I'm sure you hear this all the time, is writers are often described as either a panster or a plotter.
Right. Right.
And so I was a panster with the House of Bradbury. I just had no idea what I was doing and where the story was going. I just sat down every day and wrote, and that book came very quickly to me. And then once I finished that manuscript, I got a contract with a small press, which was a lovely experience. And then for my next two books, The Girl Made of Clay and The Second Chance Supper Club, I signed a contract with Lake Union Publishing, who's a larger publisher, and they had the first handful of chapters and synopses, but I kind of wrote after the contract was signed.
Is that some people, like we just talked to an author yesterday who realized that she can't write to a contract. Or that it's too much pressure. She prefers to have it completely written and then go out and sell it. Do you feel the pressure when you have a contract?
I do. I do, but in a way it's really motivating because you know that the book is going to become something. You know, the industry is so tricky right now. There's so many amazing writers out there, but it's really hard to get attention from an agent or a publisher. And I think for me, it's great motivation knowing that I've signed a contract and there's expectations. And I'm excited because I know that there's a deadline and I know that there is a time of year that they want to market the book. And that just makes me more excited about it. But yes, it's definitely pressure to make sure the story is right when it's supposed to be completed.
So are you writing full time now?
I'm writing full time. Yes, I have.
That's your day job.
That's my day job. And I love it. I have a family, so I definitely try and be there for them. I have three children. I'm busy. But I write, you know, kind of 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. when the house is quiet. And then everyone wakes up and chaos kind of ensues. And then everyone goes off on their day and I kind of get back to it.
I understand you use a vision board to guide you through the process.
Oh, yeah. You must have done your research.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, my gosh. I love vision boards, and I always encourage aspiring writers to do this because, a visual is so helpful and motivating. So, like, right now I'm sitting at my desk, and I have a bulletin board behind my computer monitor. And on the bulletin board are all my pieces that I wanted to look at while I was writing the Second Chance Supper Club. So I have cut out pictures, probably most of these are from Pinterest, but of the desert of Arizona, of, you know, beautifully set dining room tables, of colorful succulents. I have some quotes up there that are motivational. And I just have some images of the sunsets and things like that. Just everything that I keep referring to as I'm writing, because I want to make sure that I get the mood and the setting and all the intent in there that I wanted.
That's a good idea because, you know, sometimes you think of something and think, oh yeah, I should do that, and then you forget it.
Yes.
But if you put it up there, then it's there, and you can refer. It's there.
That's such a good point.
You know, in addition to the really incredible details about food and cooking that you included in here, there in this book, there's also a lot of detailed and lovely descriptions of flowers. Is this something that's a love of yours, or what did you have to research for this book?
You know, that actually, and I should give a shout out to the woman that inspired that, that came from my background, as a magazine writer. So before I became a novelist full time, I was writing books. And then also I had quite a number of freelance, magazine jobs on the side. And, one piece I wrote was on a florist who, went through the whole, professional schooling in New York City for florists. And I was so fascinated by that because I didn't realize that it was this sort of competitive world. I thought that, you know, if you have a knack for it and you have a desire, you can just open up your own flower shop. But she was explaining that it's much more involved than that. Mm-hmm. So I think I gleaned most of that inspiration from that interview and that story I wrote back in the day.
You know, last night, some friends and I were talking about if we had it to do over, you know, what career would we choose if anything open possibility, and we're all like close to retirement age or retired. And, you know, I forgot about one that I always thought I would love, which would be not a floral designer, but a landscape designer. So you're putting the flowers and the greenery and everything together, or, you know, a landscape architect, I guess, because that really is a talent and a skill. And it's not something it looks easy when you look at the end result.
Right.
But an awful lot goes into it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And how cool would that job be?
Yeah, I know. I used to read books. I used to get a lot of books about that, And it was, I always found it fascinating.
Well, it's never too late.
Well, that's true. Although the physical labor part of it,
yeah,
you know, I'm a little past wanting to do that.
Right. But somebody small.
Yeah. So like succulents, these, which is such a cool thing, and that they featured in Second Chance Supper Club too. These succulent arrangements, which are often live. They're not cut plants. They're live plants. Right. Do you have succulents in your home?
I do. I feel like succulents are very on trend right now.
Yes, they are.
They're being used in such a way. And if you go on Pinterest, you can kind of look up succulents and for these weddings and, you know, white tablecloth dinner parties, succulents are being used in a very elegant way. And I just thought that was, super fascinating. And I wanted to make sure I incorporated that.
And of course, Mom, you grew succulents way back before they were trendy. In your rock garden. And what are those? I can't remember the name of that one plant that has the little yellow flowers and it creeps, it vines, but it's a succulent.
I can't remember either.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, that was fun for me. I made sure that my publisher would include a few succulents on the cover of the book, and they picked some really colorful ones, so I was happy about that.
They did. I've got the book here. Yeah. I noticed that they're showing succulents in very small pots now.
Yes.
In the stores, and like in a drugstore, you'll come across a display of them. And I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, and I actually attended a wedding shower for my niece not too long ago. And one thing I didn't – this is a bit of a tangent. One thing I didn't realize at wedding showers is that the attendees get little goodie bags these days. I didn't know that was a thing, but – one of the ideas of the goodie bags was that everyone walks away with a succulent. So that's very on trend. It's everyone loves to give a gift of a succulent because it's something that's
hard to kill.
Yeah, hard to kill, and it's pretty and yeah, unique.
Exactly. Although not so unique anymore, but
well, unique in how they look, I guess.
That's true. That's true. So let's get back to your writing process. Nicole, you mentioned that you would get up, you'd like to get up and write early in the morning before everyone's up and then after everyone goes off to school. Do you write on a computer?
I do. So my writing process is sort of the same every day. I get up, I like to get up, if I can, get up before the sun gets up. Sometimes it's really hard, but that's the best feeling, is just to watch the sun come up. And I always light a candle and I always start writing in my journal. You know, it's kind of like Julia Cameron's practice in the book The Artist's Way, where she says to just write every day. And I'm a big believer in journaling, and my journals aren't sort of touchy-feely like emotional entries. They're more my intention, or what do I want for this story, or what do I want for this week, what do I want for my writing. Sometimes there are even lists. But it helps get the brain going and get that sort of writing muscle warmed up. And then when I'm done writing in my journal, I get my laptop out and I start writing on my manuscript.
And do you write quickly and like leave all the editing for the next draft, or do you tend to edit as you go?
My agent says I write very fast. and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because I'm sure half of the stuff is just, it needs to be edited out. But I do like to write quickly. And then I think about every 100 pages or so, I stop and I'll start rereading and editing. It just gives me little breakpoints along the way. I don't know how some writers will write, you know, 300 or 400 pages and not look back. I like to look back and see, okay, is this making sense? Is this doing what I want it to do? And kind of have little breakpoints along the way.
Well, that makes sense. We've talked to authors too who they write very quickly, and then the next day they go back and clean up what they wrote the day before, and then continue, and then write quickly the new material, and then, you know, they clean it, they do it every day. Others, like you said, do the whole thing and then go back, and others are like you, stopping in between, and some don't leave a page till that it's what they want it to be.
Oh, so, yeah. I had an editor that I worked for at a magazine tell me one time the best piece of advice, and she said, never turn in work hot. And that means write something and then let it sit for a while. Don't visit it. Don't look at it. It can be a day. It can be 10 days, but it's so important to just let that sit there and simmer, and you can come back with fresh eyes and really see what you missed the first time around.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's great advice, because I tell my kids that. I have two teenagers in high school, and when they have to turn in a paper, I say, don't turn it in hot. Like, you have to get it the next day. You'll always find a typo the next day.
Oh, no kidding. No kidding. And of course, you're never really done. That's one of the problems with writing, is that it can always be better.
Yes.
So how do you decide when it's good enough?
Oh, gosh. That's a great question. I think that in my heart, I just know that the story is complete. I do trust my editors. I am fortunate enough to work with good editors who will read it when I'm finished and then give me their two cents. I think if I didn't have that support system, I would be very nervous about, am I stopping at the right spot or not? But I think my heart just knows, okay, the story is complete. I've had the characters go on the journey that they were meant to go on. And now it's time to put down the pen, but it is hard.
When you're starting a new book, are you starting with with the plot in mind, or do you start with the character and then the plot comes out of the character?
It depends on the book. It's usually a little of both. And to be honest, I'm a visual person, and it's always, always either a photo or an article that sparks the story for me. So it has to be an image first, and then I build around that image. So my very first book was about Ray Bradbury's real life house in Los Angeles. And I knew that the whole story was going to be centered around that house. And then my second book was about a piece of art, and I knew my whole book would center by and large around that piece of art. And then this book was centered around the concept of underground dining. And then the characters came secondary. So it kind of depends on the book.
It seems like the theme of the book is where you start then.
Yes, yeah. I would.
Now, do all of the books have, some romantic element to them? It wasn't real prevalent in Second Chance Supper Club, but it's there, kind of simmering under the surface.
No, they don't. Most of my books do not have any romance. If they do, it's just very secondary. I'm really uncomfortable writing romance. I don't think that I do it well, so I kind of shy away from it. I don't typically read romance books, so I don't think that that's my wheelhouse.
Now, what about historical fiction? Have you ever thought about doing that?
I have played with the idea, and I have so much respect for historical fiction authors, because the amount of research and just getting it right is just so important. And I think that the getting it right part is what's intimidating, because you are representing some actual point in time in history. And if you get it wrong, people are not very forgiving. Readers aren't very forgiving. So I've thought about it. I certainly love to read historical fiction, but it's tricky.
Well, the reason I asked you that was because you do seem to like the research aspect of writing, and you probably, I would say, do more research than most contemporary fiction authors do. And so that's why I thought, maybe you'd like going all in on the research.
Yeah, maybe someday. I think, I can't speak for all readers, but I can speak for my book club. We like to pick books where we learn something. So even if it's a contemporary story and it's all fiction, it's always fun to learn something we didn't know. So I hope my readers get to learn about underground dining. You know, that's something fun and different. And I think the research is important for that kind of an idea.
Absolutely. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Nicole Meyer, author of The Second Chance Supper Club.
I was wondering about, you know, Julia's thing that she does in the city. And how did she get into that? I mean, what was her motivation to be a newscaster? How did that work out for her?
Oh, you know, I think that she always had big dreams and a vision for herself to sort of get out of her small town and be somebody important. And in her mind, that kind of importance comes from being on television. I do touch on a little bit how she did really love the beginning of her career, even though it was hard to go out and kind of be a beat reporter and go out and find stories on her own. But I think, you know, like many women, she got caught up in the idea of success. And once she hit a certain level of success, she found that she no longer recognized herself. And maybe it wasn't as fulfilling as she thought when she was younger. I think that happens to a lot of career women. You know, we are heads down making sure that we're following a certain path. But sometimes when we look up, it's like, what is this where I really envisioned myself?
Well, you know, she had, and then of course, after she had the difficulty and she was blackballed, then she was afraid people were going to recognize her. That's
yes.
Always kind of ironic.
Yeah, she was kind of raw and vulnerable. And I thought that was important because we need to really kind of tear her down in order for her to slink back to her sisters and seek redemption.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nicole, which of the characters in this book is most like you?
Oh, gosh. I don't really know. Maybe Julia. I have two sisters, and they're always paranoid. I'm going to write them into the book.
And do you?
I don't know. I think that they think I do. I'm sure that one of my sisters will think that there's parts of her that are Jenny, and parts of me that are Julia. I try not to, but, you know, I think it was Elizabeth Gilbert had said, you know, every piece of fiction is nonfiction and vice versa, because authors have to put some of themselves into a book.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I try not to, but gosh, maybe parts of Julia. I'm not sure.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, you're so involved in the story and the research. I don't know how in the world you can not put yourself into it, you know?
Right.
Very, very hard not to.
So, Nicole, you mentioned that you belong to a book club.
Yes.
And I'm sure that your books are very popular among book clubs.
I love visiting book clubs. That has been something that I have had so much fun doing over the years. I live in such a great community. And, you know, in the summers, I usually find myself visiting at least a dozen book clubs. And gosh, that they're so much fun. The women and men who are part of these book clubs, first of all, make the best food. and they're also engaged and interested. And I Skype book clubs every once in a while that are not in Oregon. But when I get a chance to visit a book club, I'm never disappointed. It's always the best interaction.
So are book clubs kind of the replacement for the old book tour?
Yes, I actually wrote an article on that a few years ago. You know, I think that this is such a different day and age where we have social media and readers can find out so much more personal information about an author online, is that I think part of that has hurt sort of the bookstore visit experience, because readers a lot of times think, oh, I can find all this out online. I don't need to attend a book reading at a bookstore. That's not always the case, but I'm finding that the attendance for whomever the author is seems to be down over the past few years in an actual store for an event. But when I go to book clubs, there's a lot of people. They're very engaged. They're all buying more books once I get there for their, you know, sisters, mothers, birthday presents, Christmas gifts. To me, the book clubs feel like the new book tour.
Now, do you have a presence, a strong social media presence also?
I do. I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And I do love it. I know it has its downfall. It can suck a lot of your time, but I do love hearing from readers. And I think that there's a lot of great authors supporting one another out there on social media. And that's been amazing as well.
Is it important that you post frequently?
Yes.
and does that take time away from that you'd rather be writing your next book?
It does take time away, but I think that, you know, I told another writer who's just beginning, I said, look, every book I write is like a new startup business, and I need to make sure that I'm connecting with my audience and marketing myself and, you know, really starting up a new idea. And so connecting with people online is part of that. It's just part of the way the business is going. And I know a lot of creative people just absolutely hate that idea, but it's important. Readers expect that nowadays. They expect to connect with the author that they like.
Of course, of course. And it's also maybe a good way to get out material, little essays that, or even information that don't go in a book. You know, you don't
Absolutely.
Have a place for this book, but hey, I can share it in my Facebook page, my Twitter feed, my Instagram. And do you have, and in Pinterest, you know, I know you use Pinterest to help build your vision board, and I'm sure you post things there too.
Yeah, I'm not as active on Pinterest as the other accounts, but I do like to go on there every once in a while.
Wow. So what can you tell us about your next book?
You know, I've started something, but I'm not exactly sure what it's going to be. I will always be the one who writes about relationships, whether they be family relationships or friendships. But I can't really talk about it too much because I'm not sure what form it will take yet.
How long does it take you from start to when you're finished to write one of these books, one of your books?
Because I've been on contract, I've had deadlines, so that does dictate the timing of it. But it usually takes me about a year to write and then a few more months of editing. And then the book is ready to go into the marketing phase.
And it sounds like you wait until one book is completely done through the editing phase before you start on the next?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. It's hard to focus if I've got too many irons in the fire.
Yeah. Do you have a list of sort of ideas? You know, like you mentioned that each one of your books was sparked by a certain visual image or film or article. And do you keep a list of things like that that have kind of piqued your interest that may end up being future books?
I do. I have a list on my phone, actually. I walk my dog every day, and I always listen to a podcast or NPR or something in my headphones when I'm walking. And a lot of times I get my ideas from listening to those things. You know, if I hear a really interesting interview on NPR, I write down, oh gosh, that could totally be a book idea. And then I'll write that down on my phone just to make sure I don't forget it.
So how long is that list?
It's pretty long, but there's some ideas that will probably get tossed because there's not enough meat to them.
Well, true. That's true.
Yeah. But it's good to have, you know, because publishers always want to know what's next. What do you have next? Because they don't want to back someone who's just a one-off. They want a career author who has a whole bucket of ideas.
Nicole, have you ever had a character surprise you when you're writing?
I did in The Girl Made of Clay, which was the book that came out before this one. I sold it to my publisher as just a perspective from the daughter. It's actually a father-daughter story. And I sold the concept of just the story from the daughter's point of view. And then I got four chapters in. This was actually before I started writing it. I got four chapters in, and I heard a man's voice in my head, and he was in a hospital bed, and he was in pain. And I thought, okay, the father needs a voice. He is very clear in my head, and he needs to have his own perspective. So that was super surprising to me.
So in that case, you wrote from a male perspective. Does that present some challenges for you?
It does. I channeled some people that I know. So that helped. But yeah, that was intimidating because I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to speak like a, you know, older grumpy man? But I somehow did it.
You've probably known a few in your life.
I have known a few. That is for sure.
Do you have like your husband or a close friend who's a first reader for you?
Yes, I have a very close friend. Her name is Gretchen, and she's usually my first reader because she reads everything that I read. We're in the same book club. She loves the same genres that I do, and I trust her wholeheartedly. So she's usually my first reader.
And she's supportive, which helps.
She's amazing. She's actually the one who sits with me a lot of times on book tour and will sit at the table with me when I'm signing books, and she's kind of my wing woman.
Well, Nicole, it's been a lot of fun having you with us today on Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Meyer is the author of The Second Chance Supper Club. Do you have some quick advice for want-to-be authors?
Yeah, I'll share what another author told me when I was first starting out. And it didn't make sense to me at the time, but it did after a while. And that piece of advice is to start small. So for me, that was just writing very small travel pieces on a blog. And then I started my own blog, and then I started getting freelance magazine jobs from there. And then I built up my confidence. You have to learn how to work with an editor. That was very important. And once I kind of went through those steps, I got bigger and bigger and finally started writing my first novel. So start small.
That sounds like good advice. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Well, actually, this is a quote from the book. It's something that Julia, one of the characters, said. Sometimes it takes jumping into someone else's life to let you step back and look at your own and sort out the problems. I think that's very good advice.
Thank you.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.